all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Many of you have probably heard of Willie Sutton. Sutton was a bank robber in the 1920s and 30s who stole an estimated $2 million over his 40-year career, the equivalent of $30 million in today's dollars. Sutton is perhaps most remembered for his witty reply when asked why he robbed banks. "Because that's where the money is," Sutton said. A slightly modified question could be applied to the man who is part of the subject of today's conversation. Why do you smuggle cocaine? Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar earned the nickname the King of Cocaine in the 1980s. At the time of his death, he was worth an estimated $30 billion. That's $58 billion by today's standards. But here is where Sutton and Escobar, the comparison departs. Sutton usually carried a Thompson machine gun or a pistol when committing the robberies. He said you can't rob a bank on charm and personality. However, in a Reader's Digest interview just before his death, Sutton confessed that the weapons were never loaded because somebody might get hurt. In Escobar's case, plenty of people got hurt. Thousands. Policemen, politicians, civilians. His vicious attacks without conscience or remorse earned him the label of the world's first narco-terrorist. On December 2, 1993, Escobar's reign of terror ended on a rooftop of a Medellin barrio. One of the men who played a role in the storied case of Pablo Escobar joins us today on American Warrior Radio. The experiences of DEA agent Steve Murphy and Javier Pena have been told in the Netflix series Narcos, Drug Lords, the History Channel's Kingpins, and the National Geographic Channel's Facing Escobar. Now, behind the scenes and personal stories of Murphy and Pena are told in a brand new book just out called Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, Mr. Steve Murphy.
Hey, Ben, I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a thrill to have you make, you know, folks don't get to come back on American Warrior very often, Steve, so I guess I'm lucky that way.
You must have been hard up to get somebody to talk on a Saturday.
Well, okay, fair enough. Touche. Steve, you know, it is a thrill to have you back. Really, the Narcos series was one of my favorite series ever on Netflix, and I'm thrilled about your new book. There is, what was the motivation for this book, Steve? I love the way it reads. It's sort of a back and forth with you and Javier, but were there some recently declassified materials that made this book possible? Because there's a lot of stuff in this book, Steve, that wasn't, I mean, you couldn't even insinuate from the TV series.
Well, you know what it was, Ben, is in the beginning, we never expected any of this to happen. The Narco series, writing a book, the speaking business that we have, all the stuff that we're doing now, which, I mean, certainly not complaining, but this is the last thing we ever thought would happen in our careers. And when the show Narcos came out, that just really kicked our speaking business up to the stratospheric level, to where we just finished our fourth season. We're off now for 2 months. Where we're doing about 75 shows a year. So we're traveling all over the world. But what we saw in our speaking business is that people are believing what they see on television. And we all know that's not true. I mean, as great as the Narco series is, it's not 100% fact. You know, we told them all the true stories. They got the chronology right. That's accurate. But they dramatized a lot. They added a lot of violence. And the purpose of our speaking business, as well as the book, is we just want the world to know the truth. That's what this is all about, is telling the truth.
Wait a minute, Steve. They added a lot of violence? I mean, that's saying quite a bit, given Mr. Escobar's reputation. But, yeah, I find that interesting. You, in kind of our doing our pre-show prep, Steve, you say, you know, we're just a couple of small-town country boys who got to work on a huge investigation. And that's really, I mean, I don't know how many DEA agents were wearing the badge at that point in time, but I mean, this had to have been the case in the world at that point in time, right? Or it turned into that.
It was. Absolutely, it was. And you know, while Javier and I, we were the boots on the ground there in Medellin for DEA, we had a lot of support in the background. You know, you had agents back in the embassy that were supporting us. We were feeding leads all over the world and agencies for DEA and other law enforcement agencies were following up on those. The intel analysts you know, I mean, they're the really smart ones, to be quite honest with you. They're the ones that helped us go on and analyzing all the information we were getting. It's just that, you know, because we were the two point guys there, we got all the credit for things that, I mean, we did what we thought was common sense and would work. And now, you know, people say, oh, it's, you know, you guys developed your strategies, were unbelievable. We're still using some of the strategies you used. And that's just not what it was about. It's just doing what made sense at the time.
Just good police work.
It was, you know, and not bragging on our abilities, but we do have, Javier and I both have a very strong work ethic, you know, and I'm sure that was instilled through our childhood, the way we grew up. And that's what it took, because you got to stay focused on your mission. You know, there were, you hate to say this, but there were actually times when we thought, you know, what the heck, this, we're never going to catch this guy. Mm-hmm. We get so close and then it just doesn't work out. But then you see your friends being killed, you know, the police officers, you see the innocent children and their parents who were in the wrong place at the wrong time when a car bomb went off. And you know what? That renews your resolve to suck it up, Cupcake, get back out there and get your job done.
You know, Steve, one thing that really struck me, and I want to get this out of the way right off the top of the bat before we get into some of these really great details in your new book. You and Javier have been called heroes, which I believe it's a title that you've earned. But I think we both agree that, you know, you talk about your Colombian counterparts, those police officers, those military officers, to some extent, those politicians who, and not to mitigate the amount of risk that you and Javier were taking there on the ground, but the higher risks of them and their families and the fact that they took their country back. And I'll emphasize that again. They took their country back. We're not talking about a neighborhood, the entire country. And that, I mean, their bravery is something that I believe comes out in your new book.
Well, and if we reach that objective, then we're perfectly happy with the book, to be quite honest with you, because that's what it's all about. Telling the truth, you know. People do call us heroes, and that's a great title to have. We just don't subscribe to it because we were two professional law enforcement officers that just went out and did our job. I mean, we knew that was a really big case, but that's the truth. It was a case, and when that case was over, we moved on to the next case. So the biggest thing we stress with every interview we do, with every stage presentation we do, we try to stress this in our book, is who the true heroes are. And just like you said, it is the Colombian National Police, because they did take their country back from this guy. He declared war on his own country twice. And if you come to our presentation, we'll tell you about how he was planning to do it a third time. I mean, this guy's completely out of control. His ego, you know, it won't fit in most auditoriums where we speak. It's just completely out of control.
And again, folks, the book just out is, well, let me back up a little bit. You can get this book if you go to DEANarcos.com. That's Steve and Javier's website. A lot of great insights into the story, what they're doing now. If you can buy the book anywhere, probably, I'm guessing, Amazon, some of these other places. But if you go to DEANarcos.com, you can get it autographed and personalized. Is that correct, Steve?
Absolutely. And we don't have people that do that for us. We handle the whole thing ourselves.
You know who doesn't have an autograph and personalized copy of your new book, Steve?
Dan.
It's my show. Shameless plug. So we're going to take a quick break, Steve. I want you to think of one question I wanted to address right off the bat, because after watching the Netflix series and following your career, there's still something that just really gets to me. So Javier was a bachelor. Okay. But you took your wife with you to a war zone. You've got a $300,000 bounty on your head. What the heck were you thinking? Don't answer that. We'll come back and talk about that. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. 80 tons of cocaine per month. That's the equivalent of 40 Ford F-150 pickup trucks Escobar was bringing into our country at the height of his power. We'll be back with more from retired DEA agent Steve Murphy. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by retired DEA agent Steve Murphy. He's one of the Batman and Robin team. I'll let you decide which is which, Steve. Steve Murphy and Javier Pena had played an integral role in taking down the international drug trafficker Pablo Escobar. Steve, I kind of teased before the break that that's something, the fact that you were there in what, for all practical terms, is a war zone with the price on your head. No offense to you, Steve, but you certainly probably stood out in Colombia. Well, I mean, did you and Connie ever have the chat, or is just, I'm going with you, I'm your wife, come heck or high water?
Well, and there's two things I'd like to point out about it. Well, there's a lot of things I'd like to point out about this, but you know what? The original idea came from Connie. She said, you know, we'd been in Miami. We'd suffered through my partner there, Kevin Stevens, being shot on a deal that went bad. Our informant was killed during that deal. You know, and that was in 89. So in 1991, she's like, you know, this has been really exciting down here in Miami. She's like, what's the next most exciting thing we can do? And I said, well, we could always go to Colombia, because I've been working some cases with our guys in Barranquilla at the time. And she looked at me like, are you an idiot? But you know what? She thought about it for a few weeks. I introduced her to an agent from Barranquilla that had come through Miami, and she grilled him for about 3 hours at dinner one night. And a couple weeks later, she came to me and she said, hey, if we're going to do it, let's do it while we're young. So it was kind of her idea to start with, and I was very happy about that. But she's a tough lady. She was when I met her. I used to ride motorcycles when I first met her. She owned her own motorcycle. Now, Ben, how can you not fall in love with a woman that owns her own motorcycle, right?
Right.
Not talking about biker chicks, but, I mean, she's a tough girl. So, and one other thing I wanted to point out was in the beginning of season two of Narcos, they show that Connie takes our baby and heads back to Miami. And that caused a major argument, because she never left me. Mm-hmm. She stayed there the whole time. You know, she knew the threats that were out there. She was under threats. She didn't have a price tag on her head, but still, just living in that environment. It's funny, because when they would write an episode during the first couple seasons, they would email them to Javier and I, and we'd read through them and try to pick out things to make the background look a little more accurate, or describe the vehicles or the clothing or the weapons or whatever they were interested in. And so, because her character is portrayed in the show, she got to read the episodes as well. Well, when she read that, where she went back to Miami, she comes waving that thing in my face, and she's fussing at me. Did you read this crap? Did you read this? You know, I never left you. I said, baby, I didn't write the stupid thing, okay?
Well.
So she ended up having words with the producers.
Steve, I'm shocked. Shocked, I tell you, that something on TV was not 100% accurate. But, well, it's still a great – well, and that really – I think the reason it makes a great TV drama and well, I'll leave it with the Netflix series. If I was sitting down to dream up this script, I couldn't think of a more diverse, bizarre group of characters and situations. We got a drug kingpin elected to Congress. He builds his own prison, storms the Supreme Court. You got law enforcement agents, both good and bad. Other rival drug lords in and out of the partnership. I mean, it's like bad fiction. And to this day, Steve, it's hard for me to just grasp the fact that all this stuff really happened.
It is. You know, when you hear those the statement, you can't make this stuff up, this applies here. And even one of the lines that the actor that plays me in the show, Boyd Holbrook, who's a fantastic actor and has become a very good friend, one of his lines is, we didn't know what we were up against. And another line is, fact is stranger than fiction. It's absolutely true, and all this was true.
Yeah, it's compelling, and that's part of the reason I love your new book, is there's so many more details in there. You know, things that kind of sort of left me scratching my head after watching the series are now answered in you're in Javier's new book. Let's talk a little bit about Pablo Escobar himself. If I were to take out the murder, the bribery, the destruction of lives, his business model almost has to be admired. I mean, this guy, as I teased before the break, and I got it off the interweb, Steve, so I don't know if that's accurate, but 80 tons of cocaine a month. I don't know what the dollar value of that is, but it's got to be a ton, if you pardon me.
It's more than a radio announcer makes, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I can bet you that, yeah. Yeah. How did he really kind of walk us through briefly how he went from just a middle-class guy to the world's most wanted narco-terrorist, and when did he really first appear on DEA's radar?
Well, he grew up poor. His father was a small-time farmer His mother's a school teacher, so they really didn't have a lot of material possessions, but he didn't like that. You know, he had seen people in the city with wealth, and, you know, he determined at an early age that's what he wanted to do. And one of his attributes was the man had no conscience. He had no remorseful feelings about people. It didn't bother him at all to kill people. The way he got involved was, you know, he started out as just a petty criminal. He was stealing hubcaps off of cars and selling those. And they were actually stealing gravestones out of the graveyards and sandblasting those down and selling them back to the companies that etched the gravestones. So, you know, there's a wonderful person to look up to there. Well, when he saw cocaine and he was introduced to that, he realized how much very quickly money he could make off of that. And the first guy that introduced it to him, he did a 17-kilo deal for the guy, saw the profit, and then turned around and killed that guy and took over his business. Well, wow. You know, people say this business model, man, he, you know, and a lot of people have presented us with that same question. If he had applied his business acumen to a legitimate business, wouldn't he have been as wealthy? Well, not really, because this is his business model. Ben, I'm going to ask you to go out here and make a delivery for me. And, of course, you're an honest man, and you say, I can't do that, so I kill you. Well, you know what? That word gets out. So that the next time I ask somebody that know Ben to do something for me, they're going to do it because they know I'll kill them. And not only would I kill you, I will kill your family as well. So this is just one horrible, horrific person. There's no great attributes about him whatsoever. Some people say, well, he was a Robin Hood because he built clinics and he built housing for poor people. That's true. He did do that stuff. But you know what? When he needed new sicarios, new assassins, guess where he went to? Mm-hmm. He went right back to those neighborhoods. And, of course, those people, you know, thought he was a god because now they've got a roof over their head and running water and so forth. But what we call him is a master manipulator. He manipulated those people to the point where they were willing to give their lives for him for nothing. He's paying them minimum wage. If they kill a police officer, he gives them $100. You know, he's making billions and billions, and he's giving them $100.
Yeah, and that's where the plata o plomo phrase comes from. I'm guessing either
yes, sir.
silver or you know, money or a bullet.
That's exactly right.
Well, he certainly brings a new twist to the phrase mergers and acquisitions. I'll leave it at that. Is it fair to compare what Escobar did for the drug cartels in Colombia to what Luciano did for the mafia as far as forming the commission, or was it never that tight, that organized?
It wasn't that organized for the Medellin cartel. We refer to the Medellin cartel and Pablo Escobar as the Wild Wild West, but then you had the Cali cartel guys, the Rodriguez Orihuela brothers and their henchmen, who stepped up and really took over. You know, they were arch enemies of Pablo Escobar. Once he was gone, they stepped up and took over. They were more businesslike. They were more organized. They realized that Pablo brought so much attention to himself. That was, you know, quite honestly, that was part of his downfall when he ran for Congress and got elected. He was elected as an alternate. And as soon as the election was over, the primary delegate stepped down, which automatically put Pablo into his position. Well, he made his first appearance in Congress is when Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, the attorney general, called him out in front of Congress for what he was, that he was a criminal. He was a drug trafficker. Of course, we know how that ended up. They killed Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, assassinated him as he's driving down the road, two guys on a motorcycle. And you know what? Javier and I were speaking a couple years ago over in Norway, and it's not unusual for Colombians will want to meet us before or after a show because, you know, quite honestly, every single one of them wants to thank us for helping to do something nice for their country. Well, this guy, he came in. Turns out he is the nephew of Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, the attorney general who was assassinated by Pablo. He was just a small child at the time, an infant, and Pablo killed his uncle and then was going to kill the rest of the family, the Bonilla family. So they, like the next day, they all packed up everything they could and moved to Norway. I mean, this young man, he's in his mid to late 20s, can't even speak Spanish. He speaks Norwegian. He speaks several different languages over there, but can't even speak Spanish.
Wow. Yeah, Norway's about as far as you can get from Colombia, I'm guessing.
Well, it's a whole lot different climate, too.
Yeah. Steve, I got to tell you, that was the only scene in the series that caused me a little bit of heartbreak in some ways, just given my personal background in politics. And now, granted, the guy's an evil man, and he got into that seat just like everything else he did. But how accurate was that depiction of his, that first and, I guess, only day in the Congress there in the Parliament?
That is based on actual events. And, you know, just to give a shout-out to Eric Newman, the executive producer and creator of Narcos, and his writing team, those guys were fabulous. I mean, the first time we went to the writer's room out in Hollywood, met with these guys, they had a library of books, most of which I'd never even heard of, about Pablo Escobar and the Colombian drug problem. Very, very well read. So they had a lot of historical background. You know, and Javier and I were able to add a few little tidbits here and there that kind of spiced it up a little bit, so it's not just, you know, a history lesson. But that is actually based on fact.
I tell you, we've got to take another break coming up here, Steve, but I do have another question for you. I love all the little details that come out in your book, Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar, things that there was probably not enough time or film to put in the series. But you talk a little bit about the meals that you would eat, you know, when you guys were there with your fellow law enforcement agents from Colombia, and it was very often a very poor, boiled, flavorless piece of chicken along with rice. And you say for the rest of your life now you've got a huge affinity for rice. So the question is, did they give you a nickname along with a $300,000 bounty on your head, something like, you know, El Gringo con Arroz, or never happened?
Never happened.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by retired DEA agent Steve Murphy. When we come back, we're going to get into some more of the details that they expose in their book, Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. We're going to talk about FARC and Los Pepes and even a little bit of Delta Force. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by Steve Murphy. Steve and his partner, Javier Pena, have got a new book out, just came out. It's called Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. You may recognize those names. They've been featured in all kinds of documentaries, but my favorite was the Netflix series, Narcos. Steve, coming back, you know, we talked a little bit about the cast of characters. If I was writing fiction, and there's a lot of details that are in your new book that weren't really divulged in the Netflix series. One was sort of confirmation of my suspicion, but the fact that we did have Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 be bopping around the country at that point in time, right?
Yes, sir. In fact, we had them living with us there in Medellin for 18 months. And I got to tell you, Ben, you know, if I'm ever kidnapped, that's who I want to come rescue me, either Delta Force or SEAL Team 6, because those guys are the studs of the world. They are unfrickin' believable. I have the utmost, I can't even explain to you how much respect I have for those people.
Well, I tell you, they're probably sitting around somewhere in the jungle saying, you know, if something goes wrong with us, we need to call Javier and Steve.
Well, they might call Javier if they need a date. You know, his Rick.
But tell us, one of the things that did come out in the film and was emphasized in the book, the relationship between your office and the DEA folks there and the CIA, not so good. I mean, you're supposed to be working together, but I guess cocaine and communists don't mix, although they really were mixing. But that's not the way that the CIA saw things, right, Steve?
You're right. And please, whoever's listening to this, don't take this as an indictment of the entire CIA. I mean, we give them a hard time because what they do is secret and they can't tell you what's going on. So they're easy to pick on. The truth is, I have a lot of respect for the CIA. I think they have one of the hardest jobs in the world because they cannot defend themselves, you know, because they can't divulge secrets. But in this particular case, the head of the CIA in Colombia, you call him a chief of station, was a jerk. He didn't like us. He didn't like us being down there. He didn't want to recognize the crossover between the narcotics groups and the insurgent groups. Well, you know what, Ben? In law enforcement, when you see that you've got FARC guerrillas providing protection on Pablo Escobar's cocaine labs, in law enforcement, we call that a clue. It's not that hard, right?
Do you think, Steve, that it wasn't that he didn't? Because, I mean, to me, even for a knucklehead like me, it seems the connection was pretty obvious. Do you think that that really, at the end of the day, though, came out to budgets and power and control? I mean, he knew the truth.
Yeah, I think it came down to his personal control. He didn't like being challenged. You know, the ambassadors calling him on the carpets because they didn't want to share any of the intelligence they were gathering. They wanted all of our information, but they didn't want to share it back. And then when we finally, the ambassador had to get involved, we finally got the correct security clearances. When we were allowed to review information that they had, he would sit us at an elementary school desk, one of those little bitty school desks with a little bitty chair, and it was sat right outside of his office so that he and his deputy chief of mission or chief of station could watch us as we go through the information. And quite honestly, almost everything we read was a teletype that we had written the day or 2 days before. We didn't see anything new. There was anything new in any of their information that benefited us whatsoever.
So you were just allowing you to read what you had written a couple of days before. Yeah, there's a high security operation at one of the bases in the towns that we operate, Steve. And whenever a civilian goes in there, all these blue lights go on, basically to let everybody know that, okay, civilians here, put the classified stuff back in your desk drawer. Was it kind of like that when you visited your friends at the CIA?
It was absolutely like that. I mean, as soon as we walked in the door, those blue lights flicked on. People didn't want to say good morning to you. They didn't want to make eye contact with you. You could tell that it was, and I guess in my own suspicious mind, I felt like they had been told, don't say anything to them. Don't tell them a word. You know, they're not here to help us.
Steve, one of the thing that also Los Pepes, which is was the nickname for they had a much longer title. Basically, I don't even know how you would describe them, but sort of a counter attack against Escobar and the drug pens that eventually, even though maybe a lot of the civilians out there and even certain agents might say, okay, I don't agree with their methods, but I'm not going to stand in their way. That really took a turn for the worst. And what was that one incident you described in the book where they lost kind of that popular support, if there was any, or what there was, I should say?
Well, you're right. When they first came out, the public was behind them 100% because what they were doing is taking Pablo's tactics, you know, his indiscriminate bombings and murders, and using them against him. Now, Los Pepes is nothing more than a vigilante group, to be quite honest with you, and that goes against everything we represent in law enforcement. You know, that's what your law enforcement, your first responders are for, is so we don't have that vigilantism out there. But the truth is they had a lot to do with bringing down Pablo. So they were killing anybody associated with his family. It could be lawyers. It could be school teachers. It could be people who are providing food, whoever. So the public opinion was squarely behind Los Pepes to begin with. But then one day they killed two of Pablo's attorneys, and one of the attorneys happened to have his 10-year-old son with him. Well, they killed the 10-year-old kid. When that came out, and in Colombia, they print the photographs. They don't edit any of that stuff out. And, you know, there's a picture of a 10-year-old lying in a hole dead from gunshot wounds. That's when the tide of opinion started turning against Los Pepes. You know, there was eventually there was talk about pulling Javier and I out of Medellin, about pulling Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 out of Colombia altogether. But our ambassador stepped up and argued with Washington and was able to keep us all there, which is what ultimately led to the downfall of Pablo Escobar.
Do you know, Steve, in retrospect, did they literally assassinate him, or was he caught in the crossfire, or we'll never know, the 10-year-old son?
I don't know for sure. I'm going to assume, though, it was an on-purpose shooting, it wasn't an accident.
One of the things that really I enjoyed about the book, and I think this was more in Javier's chapters, but we do talk about the things that we as Americans don't do, whether that's rules of engagement for our military or in your case. There was lots of opportunities for people to give you guys bribes. And in fact, there's just one, I don't want to give too much away, but there's one section where a fellow gave Javier he was admiring the guy's watch, and the guy took it off and gave it to him. Well, he wanted to turn it down, and someone whispered in his ear, if you turn it down, it might be an insult. He might kill you for that. So Javier literally puts it in an envelope right away and sends it to the DEA offices because you want to do everything to make it very clear that our DEA agents, our U.S. officials were beyond reproach in a country like that, or anywhere, I suppose.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what happened. There are systems in place to deal with that because that guy that had the watch is eventually, we found out, and we didn't know it at the time, we eventually found out he was the head of Los Pepes. He goes by the nickname of Don Berna. Mm-hmm. Diego Murillo is his real name. And you know what? After the Cali cartel was taken down, and then after them came the North Valley cartel, we took them down. After that, Don Berna became the biggest cocaine trafficker in Colombia, in the world. He's now doing a 30-year prison sentence here in the United States. We arrested him and extradited him to the U.S.
Funny how that works, huh?
I'll tell you what, you look at it in retrospect and you're thinking, holy cow, I entrusted my life to this guy. And he was the head of Los Pepes. This guy's as bad as Pablo Escobar was, you know, and we're trusting our lives to him, our safety.
Well, a case like this, you know, above all people, Steve, I mean, sometimes you get some interesting bedfellows. I'm glad that you and Javier and got out of there with, you know, without too many scratches. That still amazes me, given what was going on down there. One other thing that I really liked about the book, kind of in that same theme, was it talked about the interrogations. And I'm guessing that there were some methods used by the military or the Colombian police or agents that were, let's just say, they didn't read them their rights first. But it was very clear that your methodology or your rules were such that if I ever got to that point, you were to stand up and walk out to express your very clear disapproval of that, correct? And I don't know if there was ever a situation like that with you personally, Steve.
There was not, but those were our instructions. That's actually the policy of DEA. Because you know as well as I do, Ben, if you give up your integrity, it's not something you get back. You know, we're certainly not perfect people. We have our flaws just like everybody else. But that's one thing that you can control in your life is your personal integrity. So I got to speak to a high school graduating class. I live in Northern Virginia, right outside of D.C. It is actually the high school where one of my daughters graduated from, and she graduated several years ago, but I was their commencement speaker this past year. And that was the theme of my discussion is integrity. It's just there's so many things in our lives that you and I think we control, but we really don't. I mean, there's outside influences on just about everything we're involved with, except your personal integrity. Now, there's people out there that will try to influence your integrity. You know, there's opportunities that arise, but there's times when you got to stand up and be a man and set your foot down and say, no, I'm not doing that.
Good, great, great words. And that leads to, when we come back after the break, Steve, I do want to spend some more time talking about your Colombian counterparts and their bravery and, you know, those who were honest and who really were trying hard to take their country back and just some of the wonderful things and the credit that they deserve for successfully closing the book on Pablo Escobar. Folks, again, the book is Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. If you buy it, go to DEANarcos.com. If you buy it there, you can get it autographed and personalized. That's a great, great deal, particularly with the holidays coming up. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very excited to have Steve Murphy of the DEA Narcos fame back joining us again on American Warrior Radio. The occasion is they just released a book called Manhunters, How We Took Down Pablo Escobar. You can find out more. Visit DEANarcos.com. Steve, before the break, you mentioned speaking at your daughter's commencement ceremony. One of the real silver linings that came out of this whole experience for you and Connie was you adopted a Colombian child, a little girl, if I'm not mistaken. Was that the same one or a different daughter?
Well, what they were supposed to show in Narcos is, but they cut part of it out in season two, was we adopted two little girls down there. Monica was the first. She was 8 months old. She's from a little town north of the city of Bogota. She's now 26 and she's a college graduate, has a full-time job. out on her own. And the second daughter is Mandy. She's from Medellin. She was 5 months old when we adopted her. She's almost 26 now. I've got a birthday coming up here real soon. Married, has a little daughter that's almost 3 years old. And here's a neat story that we don't tell. I'm not sure I've ever said this anywhere else except maybe on stage a couple of times, is Mandy's given name, her birth name, was Daniela. When we adopted her, we changed it to Mandy Nicole because she is a Mandy. I mean, she's just big. She was big. She was a great athlete. But when she had her daughter, she named her daughter Danielle. So that's I always thought that's pretty cool of her.
Well, first time on American Warrior Radio. This is a day of his first day. I just enjoy chatting with you. And I please give my greetings to Javier. I'm sorry that he couldn't join us here today. My fault, my show. Let's talk about the other heroes in this whole situation, Steve. And I tell you, to me, when I was watching the series and reading your book again, one of the real heroes that stands out to me is the young man who was the son of one of the other officers. I can't recall if he was law enforcement, police, or military, but the young man who just so diligently perfected that radio tracking that really got you to narrow down where Escobar was there in that Medellin barrio that really brought this whole thing to an end.
Right, and his name is Lieutenant Hugo Martinez. His father was Colonel Hugo Martinez. His father was the head of the search block. So he's our boss in Medellin, the 600-man force, whose sole job was to try to find and take down Pablo Escobar. And the lieutenant, he trained himself on how to use radio directional finding equipment. So he was, you know, he would come and tell Javier, he'd go out every day and he'd practice with it. And he was fine-tuning his skills. And he'd come in and he'd report to us what he'd done. There was no reason for him to report to us. And you know, to be quite honest with you, his intellect was so much higher than ours, I didn't understand most of what he was talking about. But he is the man that found Pablo Escobar on December 2nd, 1993. And, you know, if you remember the series, it shows that he thought he'd located him and a special police unit went and raided a building that was empty. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. That's true. But what Lieutenant Martinez did after that, he realized that there was water in the area. Water has a direct effect on radio waves, how they travel through the air. So he recalibrated his equipment, taking that water into account. And the next time he located him, as he's driving down the street, he told us, he said, I looked up and I could see Pablo Escobar at the window on the phone looking straight at me. But there was no reaction on Pablo's face like, you know, oh, crap, the cops are here. So we've had lots of discussions about that. And the only explanation we can come up with is that, you know, when, like, I'm talking to you, I'm walking around my house as I'm talking to you today, and I'm looking out the window and I see things, but I'm engaged in a conversation with you. So I'm kind of in my mind, you know, forming my answers as we go along here. And I really don't recognize what's happening outside. I would have said something violent or something like that. But what we're thinking is that Pablo was just so engrossed in the conversation with his son that he didn't realize he was looking at a Colombian National Police officer.
Well, I tell you, it really speaks to what any idea what that young man is doing now?
Unfortunately, Lieutenant Martinez was killed in a car wreck about 10 years after Pablo died. We always suspected there was something suspicious about that, but our Colombian counterparts never seemed concerned. However, in the last year or two, Javier's gotten information from some of our old friends down there that they are taking a second look at it, that it might have actually been a hit on the lieutenant.
Yeah, if I was a betting man, that's where I'd put my money. Really, I guess, briefly, Steve, if you could emphasize, I mean, really, you guys, you kind of parachute in there, and you were taking some significant risks as well, but the extent, I know there was a bounty on your head, but this is right about the same time or shortly after Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent that was murdered in Mexico. Was there, at least with some of the more clearer thinking drug lords, was there sort of a hands off the Americans attitude, or was it just they just never got to you?
No, we believe that Kiki's legacy did have a lot to do with keeping us alive. And, you know, during every one of our shows, we always have a question and answer session at the end where people can ask us about the investigation. They can ask about narcos. We even talk about our personal lives to a certain degree. And that's one of the most frequently asked questions is how in the world did you guys survive down there? And there's several different reasons, one being Kiki's legacy. Because if you remember, that was in the early to mid-1980s.
85.
Yep. And see, I didn't come on board DEA until 87. I was a police officer, but not with DEA. And if you remember back, the Mexicans really didn't want to cooperate in the investigation. And our president stepped up and closed the border to Mexico. It took less than an hour for the Mexican government to come back and say, okay, we give, we're back in this investigation. So if you think about it, with Escobar, it's all about his power and his money, his ego, his profile of himself, however you want to describe it. If he did kill one of us, I'm not sure what the reaction of the American government was, but his belief was that we would shut down his trafficking routes. Well, then he's not making any money, is he? He's going to be mm-hmm. stuck with all this cocaine buried in holes all over the Colombia. So that's the last thing he wanted to happen. Would he like to have killed us? I'm sure he'd like to kill us himself. But I do think he feared the retribution of the U.S. government if that did happen.
Steve, let's, if you don't mind, share your perspective. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I'm curious. For me, it's still hard to grasp that an entire nation, a country, can be taken over and really brought to heel by a single criminal. Just recently, closer to home, we had 9 U.S. citizens killed 70 miles south of the U.S. border. There's really no-go zones now in Mexico. Are we approaching that kind of a failed state? I mean, for goodness sakes, they're shooting each other over avocados down there now.
I think we're at that failed state stage with Mexico. I think that our government should recognize the drug cartels down there as terrorist organizations, because that's absolutely what they are. The grisly murders that you're discussing there of the mothers and their children, the Mormons down there, I think there's probably more to that story than any of us know about. I think there's more than the media has been able to find out. I wish I knew what it was. It just, I'm not a really smart guy, but it's just not adding up as to what went on down there. I think there's a lot more to that story we need to find out. But I also think you're absolutely right. Now, people say, well, should we build the wall? I don't know. Is a wall going to stop drug trafficking coming into the United States?
No.
Probably not. Is it going to slow it? Well, it may slow it. But every time we put up an obstacle, the narcotics traffickers find out a way to get around it. So the thing about the wall is people, I think they're looking at that as a one-stop solution for stopping illegal immigrants and illegal narcotics and anything else that's illegal coming to the United States. There is no one single answer. It's just one of many different avenues that we could pursue to try to slow down what's going on, coming into our country.
Well, and Steve, you and I can have a long chat about this some other time, but I was raised in Mexico, and there's lots of other societal elements that go into probably like you saw in Colombia, where it's not just about resources and walls and guns and Delta Force. There's a lot of other reasons that happens there in Mexico. Is there an Escobar equivalent now in the world, Steve? Is there a most wanted, or have we switched to terrorists? Well, I guess he was a terrorist too, yeah?
Yeah, no, there's still individuals down there, especially in Mexico, running the different shows down there, running the different groups that are operating down there. In Colombia, we're not seeing the huge organized cartels like we did with Cali and Medellin and North Valley and even Don Berna, for that matter. You see them smaller groups. They're still making massive amounts of money. Colombia is still the number one country in the world for the production of cocaine. I hate saying that because I love the country of Colombia. I think it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever visited. And honest, hardworking people, the Colombians down there, are some of the nicest people you'll ever meet. You got to treat them with respect. They're proud people. And if you don't, they'll tell you real quick where the airport is so you get the heck out of their country. But if you go in, if you go in accepting of their culture, it's their world. You go in and accept their culture, try to get along, don't be the ugly American. One of the greatest places in the world to visit, Colombia.
Good advice coming from El Gringo con Arroz. Steve, thank you so much for spending your time with us. Again, folks, visit DEANarcos.com. You can order this brand new book. It's definitely worth a read. You can get it autographed and personalized. Steve, please give my best to Javier.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast and others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.